Brethren, today I've used the Preacher's Outline and Sermon Bible Commentary for preparing for the sermon. I'd like to put your mind at a certain location. Let's imagine that you're an astronaut. We talked about traveling at the light of speed. Let's imagine you can do that. Let's imagine you can travel at 186,000 miles per second. Now, you and I, we don't understand what that means. Let me give you a brief clue as to what that means. When you say the word Jerusalem, if you're traveling at 186,000 miles per second, when you say the word Jerusalem, you can go around the earth 7 times. Think about that for a second. You say the word Jerusalem, you've gone around the earth 7 times. That's that fast. At that speed, you can reach the moon in less than 2 seconds. At that speed, you can reach the nearest star in 4 years. At that speed, in 120,000 years, you can reach the edge of the Milky Way galaxy. 2 million years, you can reach the constellation Andromeda. And on and on, I can just, you know, give you fact after fact after fact. But I thought it was interesting with all those facts that one of the first Russian astronauts who first circled the Earth went back and remarked to the press that he went out in space and he couldn't see God. Couldn't see God. Now that's a pretty interesting perspective, isn't it? A farmer looks at cow manure as something in which he must endlessly shovel in the barn. He may look at that as a pain in the neck, but to those who are growing flowers or something like that, they view it as a heaven sent. Again, a matter of perspective. Brendan, what is our perspective of the world? It's the way we look at things. It's our vantage point, our point of view. It's how we see ourselves. It's how we see other people. It's how we see circumstances that affect our lives. Which brings us to the question, why is perspective so very important? Let's take a look at Isaiah chapter 55. Isaiah chapter 55. Verses 8 and 9. Isaiah 55, verse 8. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, nor are your ways my ways, says the Lord. So here we see that God has a much different perspective than we do. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. Our perspective isn't always in tune with God's perspective. And of course, during these days of unleavened bread, while we're trying to be in sync with God, this is something we want to think about. This is something we meditate on. And so today, brethren, if you want to take notes, you want to put something across the top of your paper, this is what I have for you today. Natural sight shows challenges. Spiritual sight shows solutions. Natural sight shows the challenges. Spiritual sight shows the solutions. Let's turn over to Exodus chapter 14, and we want to keep a marker there because we're going to be going from this chapter to other places in the Scriptures. But this is going to be our launch pad today, talking about astronauts. We're going to start here in Exodus 14. We'll be going other areas, as I said, but we'll continue to return to this area. How strong is your godly perspective? How true are you to the things that God would have you view the way God views them? Exodus chapter 14 gives us a few things we need to be concerned about. Verse 10, Exodus 14, verse 10. When Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them. So they were very afraid, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. This is one of the warning signs you and I could see, could detect if our perspective is not what it should be. Do we live in a state of fear? Not throughout all of our life, but in different compartments. You know, our life is many multifaceted. But is there a part of your life where fear is too much of a motivating force, too much of the perspective? Maybe we are fearful about our income, or we're fearful about our health. We're fearful about our marriage or our kids or schooling, any number of things. There may be certain fears we have in some areas of our life. Another warning sign about a skewed perspective we see in verses 11 and 12. Then he said to Moses, because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you so dealt with us to bring us up out of Egypt? Is this not the word that we spoke or told you in Egypt, saying, let us alone that we might serve the Egyptians? For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than that we should die in the wilderness. Now, the skewing we see here, a warning signal we see here, is a distortion of the truth. They're not speaking truth here. They're not thinking truth here. It's a distortion of reality. The reality as God sees it. Now, this may have been their perspective, might have been their reality, but it wasn't the reality that God was viewing. And again, we want to get in line with God's perspective. Verse 15, dropping down to verse 15. And the Lord said to Moses, why do you cry to me? Tell the children of Israel to go forward. Go forward. Another warning sign about our perspective is that we may be clinging to the world too much. And only each of us in our own hearts and minds can answer that question, if we're clinging to the world too much. So brethren, how are you doing right now when we're thinking about having a godly perspective? Is fear in some area of your life too much of a motivating factor? Do we tend to distort the truth? Do we tend to exaggerate what's happening in our life? Do we want to cling too much to the world and our society around us? Well, here in 2 Corinthians, again, put your marker there in Exodus 14. We go to 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 7. Here we see where God wants us to be. We see a godly perspective, something that has to be cultivated. 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 7. For it says, for we walk by faith, not by sight. We walk by faith, not by sight. How does one walk by faith? Is there a section of the scriptures that show us how to do that? Well, the answer is yes. The answer is we're going to go back to Exodus chapter 14. We're going to dissect that chapter. We're going to examine that chapter. And as you and I do that, we're going to see words from God, words of wisdom, God's own special, unique counsel that will tell us how we should be walking by faith and not by sight. Several years ago, one of the astronauts who walked on the moon was interviewed, and he was asked this question. What did you think as you stood on the moon and looked back at the Earth? Now, a person can think any number of things when they're asked that kind of a question. How many? I don't even remember how many men have walked on the moon, not that many. But if, you know, when the astronaut was asked this question, what do you think? What did you think about when you stood on the moon and you looked back at the Earth? And he's going to give a response here, and that response is going to be his perspective. He replied, I quote, I remembered how the spacecraft was built by the lowest bidder. You know, you're standing on the moon. Can I get back? I don't know if I can get back. You know, this craft was built by the lowest bidder. That was his perspective. Not, oh, the Earth is so beautiful and this. Can I get back to that good old planet Earth? Dr. Martin Luther King said this, and I quote, take the first step in faith. You don't have to see the whole staircase. Just take the first step. You don't have to see the whole staircase. Just take the first step. And brethren, we're going to talk about that as the sermon goes on today, because that is so very true. We go back now to Exodus chapter 14. Let's dissect this chapter, because this chapter has a lot to tell us about walking by faith, not by sight. It shows a lot about how natural sight shows us the challenges, but if we want to walk spiritually, our spiritual sight will show us the solutions. Point number one, for those of you who take notes, point number one, when we're walking by faith, God presents us with challenges. Now, is that any news flash to anybody in this room? You know, as a pastor to most of you and as a friend to hopefully all of you, I look out into the room today and I see any number of people who've gone through some world-class challenges in the last 12 months or so. World-class challenges. God's going to let us go through those world-class challenges. And so we're going to take a look here at this incident at the Red Sea. We're going to look at this as a teaching tool. Exodus chapter 14, verse 1. Now the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel that they turn and camp before Pihahiroth between Migdol and the sea. Opposite Baal-Zephon, you shall camp before it by the sea. So here Israel is going in a certain direction. Just like many times your life is going in a certain direction. And lo and behold, God tells Israel, well, I want you to go a different direction now. Or lo and behold, in your life, you're going in a certain direction that you're relatively happy, things are relatively peaceful. Then all of a sudden, God has you going some other direction. You know, it was interesting. Just as I was preparing this sermon, I received a phone call from a woman that calls from time to time. She lives out of state. She's a dear soul, and she called, and she was talking about the sermon I'd given on the first Holy Day. And we got to talking about that. She said, oh, Mr. D'Alessandro, she said, I've had a number of jobs here in my life, and every one of them I believe God led me to, and every one of them has been a disaster. You know, I tend to find these jobs where I work with these women, and these women are nothing but backstabbers, and they're hurtful people, and so on and so forth. And God led me to this place. Well, God is leading Israel to this place. Where has God led you this last 12 months? Maybe you felt you've been led to your Red Sea. Maybe you've had your back up against the wall. Well, this is certainly what God... And God is doing this to these people. And there's a reason God is doing this. Verse 3, so Pharaoh will say of the children of Israel, they are bewildered by the land, the wilderness has closed them in. God wanted Pharaoh to say, you know what? These people don't know what they're doing. They're zigzagging here and there. They're going to and fro. I'm going to go get them. Of course, God is in the background. He's working things out here. Verse 4, then I will harden Pharaoh's heart so he will pursue them, and I will gain honor over Pharaoh and over all of his army, so that the Egyptians may know that I am the Lord. And they did so. Brethren, I've said on so many occasions, our God is an all-inclusive God. All those people who ever lived in history, not one of them has perished and God has forgotten. Every one of them God is remembering. It says here that God was going to have honor over the Egyptian army, over the land of Egypt, over Pharaoh. And that's true. And when these people are resurrected, when they get their opportunity in the second resurrection, one of the last things one of the first things that come back to their mind is how they followed the Israelites into the Red Sea. And they're going to remember, you know, that wasn't such a bright idea because we were fighting against the real God. Not the gods of Egypt, this God of Israel. They're going to remember that. And this is going to be a teaching tool God's going to use for them. But it's also a teaching tool that God does for all of us. Leading us into areas in our life where we just feel we're being ambushed. Leading us into areas in our life where it just seems, boy, this is extremely painful. Very difficult. Verse 5. Now when it was told the king of Egypt that the people had fled, the heart of Pharaoh and his servants was turned against the people, and they would said, why have we done this? Why have we let Israel go from serving us? So he made ready his chariots and took the people with him. He took 600 choice chariots, and all the chariots of Egypt, the captains over every one of them. We talked about this on the first Holy Day. Pharaoh had his own panzer division. We talked about Adolf Hitler and how he stopped his panzer divisions just short of the troops at Dunkirk. And that was God's doing. Because the troops, the British troops, the best of what was left of the French army, they had their backs up against the wall as well. And again, God was there to teach a lesson in all of this. Verse 8, and the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he pursued the children of Israel, and the children of Israel went out with boldness. Well, it's like us many times, brethren. You and I can go through a trial. We can be successful in the trial we've just gone through. And then another trial comes, right on the heels of the trial we've just had. And there are times we're not so bold. Like we talked about last week, you've got Elijah talking about beating the odds. Took on 850 prophets of Baal, beat them all. One guy against 850, had them all put to death. And right after that, Queen Jezebel said, Elijah, you killed my 850 prophets. By this time tomorrow, you're going to be dead. You're going to die. And what did Elijah do, who just came off this tremendous, this mighty miracle? He ran for his life. He had a big pity party. He said, why me, God? I don't think Elijah's the only person in life who's ever had a pity party. I think if we had a sign-up list, we could pass it row by row. And by the time we got to the back of the room, that sign-up list would be pretty big. People have had pity parties, right? Verse 9, so the Egyptians pursued them, all the horses and chariots of Pharaoh, his horsemen and his army, and overtook them by the Red Sea. So again, brethren, when you take a look at your life, has God presented you with challenges? How does it look when he presents you with challenges? Are you and I only seeing the challenge? If you and I are only seeing the challenge and we're seeing that, you know, clear 2020 vision, if we're not seeing some of the solutions, then are we on God's wavelength like we should be? I'm not saying we should always see these things immediately, because we don't. We're human beings, we're fallible, we're clay, and many times it takes a great deal of prayer and fastings and study. But if we don't ever seem to see the solutions, then maybe there's some issues there for us, some issues there for us to think about. I'm not going to turn to these various scriptures, brethren, but think about Joseph. Joseph, you know, his brothers sold him in, talk about family issues. His brothers sold him into slavery. And you know the whole story of Joseph. And at the very end of the story, the very last chapter of Genesis, what does Joseph say to his brothers? His brothers thought that maybe, you know, he was going to take vengeance upon them. And what did Joseph say to them? He said, you know, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. And sometimes, brethren, you and I can look at our trials and we can think that, boy, this is nothing but evil. But God wants something good to come out of this trial that you and I are going through. Think about Esther. You know, here's a beautiful young woman, and she's put in harm's way, and she's put a tremendous amount of weight is put upon her shoulders, where she has got to be thinking about all of her people around the known world. And she, like any human being, she had second thought. She was thinking about maybe I could just run away. And her family member, Mordecai, we don't know whether it was her cousin or her uncle, but Mordecai said, you know, Esther, I think you and I have come, God has put us for this time and this place. Brethren, what are you going through right now? Whatever you're going through right now, God has put you there. You were perhaps at your Red Sea. You were at the base of your Mount Everest. And God has led you there. Because God has something in mind for you. We say we want to know God's will. If we know God's will, everything will be okay. In times past, I've gone through Acts chapter 16. It's a good study for you. Go through Acts chapter 16. Paul wants to go to a certain area and preach the gospel. And that's a good thing. God says, no, you're not going to go to that area and preach the gospel. I want you to go over to northern Greece. I want you to go over to Macedonia. You go over there, you're going to preach the gospel over there. And so Paul and Silas, they go there. They're following God's will. They get there, and what happens? Well, one of the first things that happens, they've got to deal with a woman who's demon-possessed. And then after they, you know, when they deal with her, the people who were around her, who used her for, you know, fortune-telling and that sort of thing, they began to lose their livelihood. When they began to lose their money, they began to complain to the authorities, and Paul and Silas were brought to the authorities. They were stripped down. They were beaten. They were thrown not only in jail, but in solitary confinement. Now, these are two people, Paul and Silas, who are following the will of God. So, brethren, we can follow the will of God, and sometimes we're going to have some real interesting times. We can't just look at the challenge. We have to ask God to show us with spiritual insights what the solutions are. So, point number one, God presents us with a challenge. Point number two, look to God's instruction. Look to God's instruction. So many times we want to look to our other places for instruction, but we always go first. What is God's instruction? Let's go back there to Exodus chapter 14. Exodus chapter 14, verses 13 through 15. Let's take a look at God's instruction here. And Moses said to the people, do not be afraid. So the first thing he says here is, fear not. Fear not. And obviously these people were confronted by a very dire circumstances. You know, it wasn't like as though, well, should I get a red car or a blue car? You know, should I have one piece of pie or two pieces of pie? You know, it wasn't anything like that. It was, am I going to lose my life? Is my wife or my spouse and my kids and my grandkids, are they going to be slaughtered by Pharaoh and his army? We're talking about some pretty dire things, some things people could naturally be afraid of. You know, in a church, we've got people, not only in our church here, other churches in Michigan, people I talk to via email from all around the country, members facing bankruptcy, members facing long-term unemployment, other financial difficulties, people facing relationship issues, divorces, separations. People call me and they say, well, my children no longer talk to me. I don't get a chance to see my grandchildren. These are difficult things. People have various diseases, you know, cancer and other issues. Big deals. Deals with which it would be easy for us to be fearful. And as a human being, understandable for us to be fearful. But one of the things we see here, it says, don't be afraid. Now, brethren, I've been through difficult circumstances too. I made mention of that on the first Holy Day. You know, I don't need to keep on repeating that. But there were times when if God would have taken my life, that would have been fine by me. I came to see that was a very selfish way to look at life and repented of that. But, you know, we've all been in a very dark place from time to time. But we also have to realize when we're in those dark places, we've got to look to God. When Elisha's servant saw the armies around the camp where he and Elisha were camping, and he was so fearful of this vast army that was around him, Elisha said, Father, show them what we've got. And Elisha's servant, his eyes were opened, and he saw this whole army of angels around their position to take care of them. Going back to Exodus chapter 14, so one of the things, you know, we need to look to God and not be fearful. It says, stand still and see the salvation of the Lord. Stand still. Stand firm. Don't waver. You know, there's a time for everything. There is a time for, you know, looking at things. There's a time for action. You know, we as Americans, we love to act. We're action people. But there's a time to stand firm. There's a time to just stop and think and get our bearings, to recalibrate our thinking. If we're terrified, we've got to go to God and say, Father, I'm terrified at what I'm facing, and you've got to help me get away from that. We need time to stand still, to get on God's wavelength and get away from Satan's wavelength. Stand still, it says. Stand firm. And we need to stand firm. In your notes, you might want to jot down 2 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 7. I'll read it for you. For God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and a sound mind. If we've got the spirit of fear, we don't have enough of the spirit of God. We need to ask God for more of that. Ask God for Him to enhance our hearts and our minds. You might jot down 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 58. Again, I'm not going to turn here. I'll read it for you. 1 Corinthians 15:58. Therefore, my beloved brethren, be you steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, for as much as you know that your labor is not in vain in the Lord. So be steadfast, be unmovable. We go back and we see something else. We're told not to be afraid. You know, we're told to stand still. But after we've stood still, after we've recalibrated our thinking, we've got our spiritual bearings, we've gone to God, then what does it say here in verse 15? And the Lord said to Moses, why do you cry to me? Tell the children of Israel to go forward. So here's a third thing that God is telling the people there. And to put it in a vernacular, God's saying, would you stop crying and get moving? Stop crying and get a move on. Now, as Solomon said, there is a time for everything under the sun. There is a time for tears. There is a time for crying. There's a time for sorrow. But then there's also a time, brethren, when you and I quit blaming ourselves. There's a time when we quit blaming other people. There's a time when we stop our analysis. We stop all the planning because we've done enough. We've probably done it 3 or 4 times over. There's a time to simply arise, get up, and move forward. Get a move on. And just as these people had to do, they had to trust God to roll back the problem, to roll back the Red Sea. And you and I need to have faith that God will roll back our issue, whatever that issue may be. Again, I'll quote John chapter 9 and verse 4. I'm not going to turn there. John chapter 9 and verse 4, where it says, I must work the work of him who sent me while it is day. For the night is coming when no one can work. The night is coming when no one can work. So there's a time to stop, stand still. There's a time, though, to stop our crying and move forward. And brethren, I'm not trying to be heartless here. I've had my share of times of crying and tears just like you have. But there comes a time, I know there's come several times in my life where I had to stop the crying and say, you know, enough of that. I can be maudlin and mourning and crying and looking over my shoulder the rest of my life. And what does that get me? That doesn't get me down the road. That doesn't get me where God wants me to be. It's where Satan wants me to be. Stuck in a ditch. Stuck in a rut. Stuck in a grave. We don't want to be there. So point number two is look to God's instruction. Point number three, let's go back to Exodus 14. Point number three is look to God's intervening power. As we're walking by faith, as we're looking for at spiritual sight to show us the solutions, number three, we want to look to God's intervening power. Because God's going to make a way. We don't know how He's going to do it. Brethren, did it seem plausible, if you were there with the Israelites before it happened, that it seemed plausible that God was going to open up a sea? Did that seem like the solution? I mean, God could have taken and just totally killed all the Egyptians. He could have had an earthquake swallow them up. There's any number of things that could have happened, but for the Red Sea to have opened up? You know, it's interesting, just as a side note, as I was researching this, when you're researching the route that the Israelites took, you've got people who say, well, you know, the Israelites took this route and they went by the Reed Sea. You know, they kind of waded through this pond to get away from the Egyptians. I'm thinking to myself, give me a break. But when you take a look at the, I didn't realize the dimensions of the Red Sea. There's parts of the Red Sea. And I'm not saying this is where Israel went through, but there are parts of the Red Sea that is over a mile deep. The average depth of the Red Sea is over 1,300 feet, and that's the average depth. Now, by comparison, the average depth of Lake Superior is 500 feet. Now, can you imagine, brethren, you and I, we're as a group, we're standing at the foot of the Lake Superior, and all of a sudden God says, I'm going to roll back the water, and you're going to walk across Lake Superior? At that point, they said, you know, we need to get another pastor besides Mr. D. You know, he must have fallen out of bed. He must have hurt himself somehow. Now, that man, there's something wrong with that man. Okay, Exodus chapter 14, verse 16. But lift up your rod, stretch out your hand over the sea, and divide it. And the children of Israel shall go on dry ground through the midst of the sea. And indeed I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians, and they shall follow them, so I will gain honor over Pharaoh and all of his army, his chariots and all of his horsemen. And of course you understand what takes place here. That Red Sea is opened. It's divided. And who are these people? Who are these Israelites? Brethren, they were God's redeemed. They were God's redeemed. Who are you? Who am I? We are God's redeemed. God's redeemed. And just as God took care of them, God will take care of you and I in a way that you and I would never even consider. In this situation, He opened up a sea. Water on either side. Tremendous sight. You know, you can think about the Apostle Paul. I'm not going to turn there, but in your notes you might want to jot down 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verses 9 and 10. Paul wanted a miracle so that he would be healed. You know, the inferences we get from Scripture were that Paul was going blind. In one of his letters he said, now see how I'm writing to you, I'm using these large letters as I'm writing to you. So it may well have been that, you know, Paul was, any time that people took rocks and they pelted him with those rocks, maybe one of them found a mark near his eye or on his eye, and he was going blind as a result of that. And he asked God for a miracle. He asked God to give him healing. You know something? God didn't heal him. There are any number of people sitting in this room who have asked for healing, and God hasn't healed you. I'm still wearing glasses. I'm still basically deaf in one ear. God's not healed. I've got very, very flat feet. I make a nice impression of a duck. You know, I get my feet wet and I'm walking around. But God's not healed those things. Now, is it because Randy D'Alessandro doesn't have faith? Well, that may be a part of the solution, but maybe not. Was Paul a man of faith? Absolutely he was. The people in Hebrews chapter 11, were they people of faith? Absolutely they were. So sometimes, brethren, I think we kick ourselves for the wrong reasons. It may not be a matter of our faith. It may simply be a matter where God says, you know, you want me to perform this great, mighty miracle in your life right now, and I'm not going to do it. But what I am going to do, as he said to the Apostle Paul, God said to Paul, he says, my grace is sufficient for you. I will give you my strength on a daily basis to get through that day. And brethren, I think that's miraculous all to itself. I think when God gives us a miracle on a daily basis of just getting through the day, just getting through the day. I know a number of people in our church culture whose family members will not speak to them because they're a part of another church, and that church does not allow them to speak to their family members. How sad. How sad, you know, those of us who love our families, and I'm sure that's all of us, how sad if you wouldn't be able to talk to your kids or your grandchildren because of a church as a part of our church culture. How sad. So point number three is look to God's intervening power. Look to God's intervening power. Point number four. Ask God to help you take that first step. Ask God to help you take that very first step. Many times, brethren, that first step's the hardest one. That first step is the hardest one. Before Israel can cross the Red Sea, they had to get right up to it. They had to get right up to that thing. And that was an awesome thing to behold. You know, I'm sure God allowed them to have really good vision that night. You know, you had between 2 and 3 million people, and they had to pass through that Red Sea in one night. Of course, you have mathematicians who, they do the calculations, how wide would the opening have to be for 2.5 to 3 million people to pass a given point in one night? Mostly the mathematicians say that the gap had to be at least a half a mile across, maybe a full mile across. Couldn't be 10 people marching at a time. One person figured that out. If you've got 10 people marching at a time, it's going to take you 14, 15 days. No, but they went through there in one night. But I bet you God gave them great vision. I bet the light of that moon was as bright. It wasn't a full moon, but I bet you it was as bright as it could be. So God could let those people see what they were getting themselves into. Now, I know a little bit about taking those first steps. I remember so many times when Mary and I have an extra long weekend, three-day weekend or something. If we can sneak off, we like to sneak off and go to Chicago. It's a great town. We enjoy going there and seeing the sights. Here, a few years ago, we took a trip over to see some of Mary's family. It was her niece and her niece's son in Chicago. And we were taking in the sights, and one of the sights we wanted to see was the old Sears building. Now it's called the Willis Building or the Willis Tower. And the Willis Tower is 108 stories. It's 1,450 feet high. At the time it was built, it was completed in 1973. It was the tallest building in the world. Tallest building in the world. Held that record for 25 years. It's still the second tallest building in the United States. It's the eighth largest freestanding structure in the world. Well, if you go to the Willis Tower, the Willis Building, on the 103rd floor, you've got an observation floor. And you don't go up there free. I think it costs us $18 a ticket just to get to that floor. And when you're looking out the windows, in a good day, a clear day, you can see four different states. On that floor, on that 103rd floor, they've got several of what they call these cubicles. They're plexiglass. They go about four and a half feet out from the building. And it's plexiglass all around. Plexiglass underneath, clear, the sides, the top, everything. And when you look under that thing, there's no support. There's no beams or girders. You just walk out 4 feet, and you can look straight down 103 stories. Now, Mary's a brave little thing. She wanted to get into that, and you know, she wanted to go for that. And she said, come on, Randy, you can do it. And I thought, well, you know, us and the chickens will be in the back. And so we stood in a line. I thought, okay, D'Alessandro, my underwear's not pink. Let's go for this. And so I'm thinking about this. Just as the Israelites were thinking about taking that first step between the water and the Red Sea, I'm thinking about taking that first step onto that plexiglass thing. And the closer I got to that, the more my bravery was melting away. Just before us, there was a fella and a woman. I don't know if this is his girlfriend or his wife or who this was, maybe his sister. But he wanted them both to get out there just by themselves. And, of course, everyone's accommodating. And they got out there, and the poor woman was shaking like a leaf. I mean, she was like this. And he had her lay down flat on her back so that he could take a picture of her face. And I'm thinking, you know, we should take that guy out and beat him. But bless her heart, she did that, and she felt so vulnerable. She was literally shaking. But when it came time for Mary and I, she just jumped out there, you know, her little size, 6 feet, she's jumping. Oh, that is wonderful. Where's Randy? Have fun, lady. I don't know who you are. Mary who? So, brethren, sometimes taking that first step is the hardest thing to do. Whatever we're doing in life, sometimes taking that first step is the hardest thing to do. And that's what Israel had to do. They had to, you know, go there with God and take that very first step, which is difficult. Exodus chapter 14, verse 15. Exodus 14, verse 15. And the Lord said to Moses, "Why do you cry to me? Tell the children of Israel to go forward." So they had to take that first step, and they took it. So point number four is ask God to help you take that very first step. Point number five. I've got seven of them here. Point number five. Point number five is trust that God will be with you with each succeeding step. Trust that God will be with you with each succeeding step. One step doesn't get you anywhere, right? There's a lot of steps we need to take if we're going to make a journey with God's help. So we need to be thinking that God is going to be with us with each succeeding step. Exodus chapter 14, verse 21. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night, and made the sea into dry land, and the waters were divided. The word divided here is an interesting word in the Hebrew. It's like you split a log. It's like you take a rock and you split a rock. It's not like it's, you know, just this light little splitting here. We're talking about an aggressive, violent splitting of the Red Sea. God ripped that sea in half to let his people go through it. So verse 22, so the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea on dry ground, and the waters were a wall to them on the right hand and on the left. How many of you have been to Niagara Falls? Probably all of us have been to the falls, have been on Maid of the Mist, right? You enjoy that? I enjoyed that. You know, you get on this boat, this, I don't know what that thing would hold, maybe a couple, 300 people, and they give you a raincoat, and because if you don't wear a raincoat, you're going to be soaking, because they take you right to the foot of the Horseshoe Falls. And every time, I think I've done it two or three times, every time I've done that, the little ship, you know, gets there to the foot of the Horseshoe Falls, and you're looking down at this water. And the Horseshoe Falls are only 170 feet. Only 170 feet. But when I'm there, I'm thinking, okay, I'm an Israelite, and I'm going through the Red Sea, and this is what it looks like. This is what it looks like. Powerful water. I'm like a little gnat. All that stuff starts coming onto me. There's one drowned Italian there. You know, you've got to trust God for every step and every succeeding step. So God opens this sea up. And, you know, people are looking at that. They're standing in line. They're making the first step. They got in line. You know, the Israel had to be, you know, they were organized. They were organized into companies. And, you know, the first company starts to go into the Red Sea. And then there are all these other people behind. Just like me at the Willis Tower, the closer you're getting to your turn, the more and more difficult it's going to be. The more and more difficult it's going to be. The water's been divided. You're in that, like the Horseshoe Falls type setting. And you're waiting your turn. You've got to ask God to give you the help you need when it's your turn to take the succeeding steps. Back in the 1970s, there was a movie called Jaws. Probably most of us have seen that movie. Story about a great white shark who did his share of damage to a small town, eating various and sundry people. I remember seeing that movie, and it was kind of interesting. After I think it was 76 or 77, somewhere in there. Right after the movie, I took my kids out swimming. That wasn't the brightest thing to do. So I'm over at Stony Creek Metro Park. I'm in the water. I'm swimming with my kids. And, you know, wouldn't you have those little tiny fish that come start nibbling on you? I was like a porpoise up in the air. And there's no great whites there at Stony Creek Metro Park. But it was interesting in that movie. Robert Shaw played the man who ran the boat called Orca. And his name in the movie is Quint. And Quint was talking about his being on the Indianapolis in World War II. Those of you who never saw the movie, there was a heavy cruiser during World War II called the Indianapolis, named after the city. That ship had the duty toward the very end of the war of delivering parts for the very first atomic bomb, so that bomb could be dropped on one of the cities of Japan, Hiroshima. So the Indianapolis does its job. It delivers its parts. It's coming back home. It's still under secrecy as to what its mission was. On July 30th, 1945, the Indianapolis is torpedoed. That heavy cruiser goes down in 12 minutes. There were roughly 1,200 men on board, 1,196, roughly 1,200 men. 300 men went down with the boat, with the ship. 900 men went into the water. And those 900 men were in shark-infested waters for a number of days. 900 men went into the water. And as Quinn says, and I looked it up to make sure it was accurate, of the 900 men who went into the water, and they stayed there for several days waiting for their rescue, by the time one of those seaplanes came in to rescue them, the men got in line. And if you remember the story, Robert Shaw or Quinn said, you know, the most scary thing for me was waiting in line, waiting for my turn to get into that airplane. You know how many people of 900 were saved or rescued? 317. Over almost 600 men were taken by the sharks. And they saw it all. They got themselves in little tight little groups and tried to fight the sharks off. But two-thirds of the men went down with the sharks. So sometimes waiting your turn takes a lot of faith. Waiting your turn for God to answer your prayer. Waiting your turn for God to intervene in your life. Waiting for God to open a door for you. In the movie, Quinn said, I'll never put a life vest on again. I'm not going to wait like that again. The bottom line, his thought was, I'd rather die than do that. So here we see the Israelites. They had to wait their turn. And that meant that they had to have faith with each succeeding step as they went through that Red Sea. Brethren, you and I need faith with each succeed. No matter what trial you and I may be going through now or will in the future, we need faith with every step. First step is big. Every succeeding step is also big. Point number six. Realize that your reward may come in the future. Realize your reward may come in the future. So in this story, as you're well aware, in Exodus chapter 14, Israel goes the whole nation, 2.5 million or so, they make it across in safety. But brethren, when they did that, they were just leaving Egypt, basically. They were just leaving the reach of Pharaoh and his army. They weren't in the promised land yet. You know, as you and I go through the trials we go through, and we're successful, doesn't mean we've made it. We've just come a certain distance. The trial you're going through now, you will have victories, and I will have victories. But just because we've got victories along the way doesn't mean we're there yet. We've got to have faith that God will be with us till the very end. The first step, each succeeding step, all the way through to the very end. To the very end. Deuteronomy chapter 8. In verse 2, Deuteronomy chapter 8 and verse 2, and you shall remember that the Lord your God led you all these 40 years in the wilderness to know, to humble you, to test you, to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. So yes, as we go through life and we've got these challenges that beset us, Many times they will be of long standing. They will tend to want to wear us down, grind us into powder. And God allows that, not because he doesn't love us, but because he does love us. Because when he's all said and done with us, he wants a tremendous work to have been done. He wants us to be the very family of God in his kingdom. Hebrews chapter 11. Let's go to the faith chapter. Hebrews chapter 11. I've talked about this. Let's take a look at this. Hebrews chapter 11. Verse 32. And what more shall I say? For a time would fail to tell me if Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah, David and Samuel the prophets, who through faith subdued kingdoms. That took some time, didn't it? You didn't just have one victory and you claim, well, I'm to my goal, I'm done. Worked righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouth of lions. Probably they're referring to Daniel. Quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword. Out of weakness were made strong, became valiant in battle. Turned to flight the armies of the aliens. Women received their dead raised to life again. Others were tortured. And remember, brethren, we're talking about heroes of faith. God didn't remove them from being tortured. Not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection. Still others had trials of mocking and scourgings. Yeah, there are times when you go to work and people, they say all sorts of things about you improperly. I hear any number of times from people who email me or phone me and say, you know, it's just so hard when I go to work, and what the people say, and the lies, and there's just no way for me to combat that, they say. And it's just, and I bring out these examples and say, well, you know, maybe it helps, maybe it doesn't, but you're in very good company. You know, God's people have always had to go through trials of mockings, and in this case also scourgings, imprisonment. Notice verse 37, they were stoned. They were stoned. They were sawn in two. That phrase there, sawn in two, probably refers to Isaiah, the prophet. A great man of God, stuffed in a log, the log sawed in half. Were tempted, were slain with a sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute. Some of God's people, brethren, they didn't have a social net. They were financially ruined. When the Apostle Paul came after the New Testament Christians, they had to scatter. They left their homes. They didn't have social security to fall back on. They had some really hard times. And when they went through their hard times, what did they do? Did they curse God? What does the Bible say? You know, we had a sermon, I gave a sermon on this some months ago. You know, what do you do after the worst day of your life? Well, and those people, they lost their home, they lost all their income, they lost everything. And what does it say about them? When they got to where they were going, did they shut up and say, I don't want anyone to know I'm a Christian? No, they proclaimed the truth of God. Nothing was going to deter them from doing the work God had called them to do. Now, I'm sure they used wisdom and so on, but they just didn't become, you know, an anonymous group of people. They had to realize, as we see here in this chapter, chapter 11, verse 8, by faith Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to the place which he would receive as an inheritance, and he went out not knowing where he was going. Faith means we're living by faith. We're not living by sight. We don't always see, as Dr. King said, we don't always see the whole staircase. God will help us to see that very first step. And then he has to help us see the succeeding steps. Verse 9, by faith he dwelt in a land of promise, as in a foreign country, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. For he waited for the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. He was looking for something of God. Not of this world. Dropping down to verse 13. All these died in faith, not having received the promises. Not having received the promises. So brethren, there are times when our reward comes in the future. The kingdom of God. How many times have you and I seen people who stopped coming to church because they felt because they tithed or they kept the Sabbath or the holy days, that God was going to give them the best house, the best car, the best job, the best family? Just doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way. God can give us those things, but he doesn't have to give us those things. Some people come considerably short of that, but they have tremendous spiritual blessings. Verse 14, for those who say such things declare plainly, they seek a homeland. And truly, if they had been called to mind the country from which they had come out, they would have had opportunity. Verse 16, but now they desire a better, that is, a heavenly country. They desire the kingdom of God. So point six, realize your reward may come in the future. And lastly, point number seven. Point number seven, give God thanks for the victory. Give God thanks for the victory. Let's go back one last time. This time we're going to go back to Exodus chapter 15. Exodus chapter 15. I think it was 3 years ago that I gave a sermon where I went through this whole chapter. This chapter is called the Song of Moses. It's the first song written in the Bible. It's a song of thanksgiving to God for what God did for the nation, giving them victory over Pharaoh and the Egyptians. And just like any song, it's got a number of stanzas. The first verse is like a prelude. If you're taking notes, stanza number one would be verses 2 and 3. Stanza number two would be verses 4 through 13. And stanza number three would be verses 14 through 18. Verse 1 talks about the triumph of God. That first stanza, verses 2 and 3, talks about who God is. Second stanza, verses 4 through 13, talks about what God has done. And the third stanza, verse 14 through 18, talks about what God will do. You know, brethren, there are so many times where you and I need to get on our knees. And, you know, just as we've got a model prayer there in Matthew chapter 6, Exodus chapter 15 is an excellent chapter. When you're getting on your knees and you're praying before God, it's an excellent chapter for you to open up and use this as a model for how to give thanksgiving to God. For who He is, for what He's done, and what He will do. What He will do. Exodus chapter 15 and verse 1. Then Moses and the children of Israel sang this song to the Lord and spoke, saying, I will sing to the Lord, for He has triumphed gloriously. The horse and its rider He's thrown into the sea. Now, I'm not going to go through the whole chapter here. You can go back and take a look at an old sermon of mine. I think it's like 3 years ago. It's online. You go there and listen to it again if you want to. But the term triumphed gloriously is a construction showing exuberance over the victory that the people have because of God. The exuberance they have because of God. Israel stood on the other side of the Red Sea. And they were able to stand on the other side, the side that, you know, from the far bank where they began, because of the grace of God. Brother, how many times have I quoted one of my favorite verses, Romans chapter 5 and verse 2? That we stand in the grace of God. Romans 5, 2. We stand in that grace. As they were standing on the other side of the Red Sea by the grace of God, so do you and I stand by the grace of God on the other side of our Red Sea, on top of our Mount Everest, or on the other side of our Mount Everest, or through Mount Everest, whatever way God wants us to get there. Verse 1 says, the horse and a rider were thrown into the sea. Again, this is a very pictorial expression in the Hebrew. And what is being shown here in the Hebrew is that God took each individual Egyptian soldier and threw them one by one into the sea. The point that I get when I read that is that God takes a look at your life. He sees all of the ramifications of your life, and He deals with each individual thing one at a time. I think I made mention a number of years ago, well, a lot of years ago, when I was still an ambassador college student. One of my friends owned a motorcycle. And fool that I was, we used to go driving all over the place on that. He always drove. I was always on the back end. And, you know, he always had ball tires and, you know, driving down the road in that thing. And I'm always looking behind my shoulder. And there's always some semi right behind you. But we went all over the place as young kids, foolish. And we thought we were something and, you know. But one day, somebody was washing off their truck or something, and there was grease all on the road. And we were coming around a corner, and we saw that grease, and we thought, oh, great. And he began to power down his bike, and power down fast enough, and sure enough, we hit that. We went over on our side, we started skidding. You know, and I'm thinking, boy, don't we look, you know, if the girls are watching us now, don't we look great? Yeah, we look really tough now, don't we? You know, tearing off skin and clothes and all that sort of stuff. But you know, I had a lot of cuts on my hand, and I couldn't just look at my hand and do a quick wash and say, that's going to do the job. I had to attend to every little cut, every little scratch. If I didn't, then they would become infected. And the same thing is true in our life. The same thing is true here in Exodus chapter 15, verse 1. As God took each individual soldier and did away with them, God will look into your life and clean each little cut that you have in your life. Each little cut. And we need to go before God and ask Him to take care of each one of those little cuts. Otherwise, they'll become infected and we won't have good health. Of course, we're talking spiritually here. So today, brethren, we took a look at Exodus chapter 14. We tore the chapter apart, and as we dissected it, we analyzed it. We saw that natural sight shows us the challenges, and as human beings, we see those only too clearly. But we also saw that spiritual sight, as we walk in faith, spiritual sight shows us the solutions. And as we went through chapter 14, I gave you 7 points that I think God wants us to see. Let me go through those one last time for you, and we'll be done for the day. Number one, God presents you with a challenge. Number two, look to God's instruction. Number three, look to God's intervening power. Number four, ask God to help you take that very first step. Number five, trust that God will be with you through each succeeding step. Number six, realize your reward may come in the future. And number seven, give God thanks for the victory. Brethren, I'm hoping that you have a great rest of the day. We'll talk to you after services.